Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument in Bohatch versus Butler and Bindman.
Yes, please, the court. I'm Elliot Tucker, Houston.
We would have told you that.
I'm here with Dick Thomas, who will assist me today. I have the honor of representing Colette Bohatch, who is present. The Court of Appeals' opinion has raised a frightening barrier to a law partner who wants to comply with the ethical reporting requirements that this court has imposed upon attorneys in this state.
Well, first of all, she's not a member of our bar.
That's correct, but the decision of this court today and the decision of the Court of Appeals will affect members of this bar. The fear of those attorneys is that they will report an unethical act and be expelled by their partners.
Supposing that she were a member of this bar, or that we're attempting to interpret what the D.C., whatever their local court of appeals is called, who has the duty to report to? I mean, if you see something wrong, if you find what you believe to be an ethical violation, and there is a duty to report, does that go to reporting it to a fellow partner?
In Texas or in D.C.?
Or if your pick, both.
In D.C., Ms. Bohatch read the rule. She first consulted Mr. Powers, the other partner in D.C., in the D.C. office of Butler and Bindman, about what it meant. And then she talked to a number of lawyers about what it meant and what her obligations were under that rule. And she came to the conclusion that her obligation was to report it to Lewis Payne, the managing partner.
Was under the D.C. rules then in effect. Prior to the ones that are now in effect.
That's right. The D.C. rules that affected her at the time that she acted. In Texas, the general rule is that the requirement is that an attorney report it to the grievance committee. However, note 4 of the rule indicates that there may be circumstances where a junior partner can comply with the rule by reporting it to the managing partner of the firm. Consumers of legal services.
If one is going to comply with this rule, is there subsequently a duty to cooperate with any investigation that a grievance committee might undertake? And what does the record say about your client's cooperation with a D.C. investigation?
The record says nothing about it. And the reference in their brief is outside the record, Your Honor, and I don't wish to get into what is outside the record. The answer to your question is, I'm not sure what the rules require, but generally speaking, one would expect a lawyer to cooperate. But I don't think there's any evidence in the record that she did not cooperate with the D.C. record, with the D.C. Bar Committee. But consumers of legal services in this state and lawyers who have integrity and want to do the right thing have a stake in the reversal of this Court of Appeals opinion. The three most significant errors by the Court of Appeals are, one, it has created the first exception to the traditional definition of fiduciary duty in this state. In so doing, it has lowered the standard and has invited others to seek other exceptions.
Is there any difference between a partnership, say if you and I put our life savings together into selling lawnmowers, and a partnership that is spread over different states or even different countries that involves hundreds of people where there are hierarchies of decision makers? Or does the same Fitzgerald and Hull language, one size fits all?
The jurisprudence in Texas at this point says that one size fits all.
And does that need to be modified in light of marketplace changes over the last 15 years?
No, Your Honor, particularly as it relates to law partners, because in Judge Cardozo's words, it is not the morals of the marketplace that controls the fiduciary relationship among partners, but the highest punctilio of honor. And that applies particularly to attorneys, because we are officers of the court. We are not merely businessmen. We have...
Is there a different standard, in your view, between partnerships of lawyers and partnerships of other business enterprises?
There is not a different definition of of fiduciary duty, Your Honor. I think that the
Should there be?
I don't think so. I think if we begin making exceptions, as the Court of Appeals has, we're on a slippery slope toward a lot of litigation. Every time a fiduciary is caught with his or her hand in the till, there will be a hand raised and say, there is an exception for me. The definition of fiduciary duty has served this state well. It has not created a substantial amount of litigation. There's not a lot of precedent. It has not caused lawyers or other partners to sue each other willy-nilly. And the standard has served us well, and what we are asking is that this court restore the traditional standard that has served this state, lawyers, and business people alike throughout its history.
What do you say the standard is when you were seeking to expel a partner? What is the standard of duty or standard of care that a partnership has to exercise?
The standard is the duty that was submitted by the trial court to the jury. And I don't think this court should make an exception for expelling a partner, because then we have to ask, is there an exception for admitting a partner, for changing a partner's points, for sending the partner to the D.C. office?
Which is you can't act in bad faith. That's the basic standard?
Well, it's the standard is that you must act with the highest honor, loyalty, no bad faith.
Every partner has to put every other partner's well-being ahead of himself or herself.
That language is not in the definition that was submitted to court. That is to the jury, that by the court. That is frequently part of the discussion of what
and
this
it
means.
Can be, can it? And when you're setting compensation among partners, you can't say, oh, here, take this.
Of course not.
At some point, you've got to say, I get some too.
That's correct. That's
you're,
absolutely correct.
You're not arguing that Butler and Binion could not expel Ms. Bohatch from the partnership, are you? Pursuant to the partnership agreement?
Pursuant to the partnership agreement, if they had done what the partnership agreement required early on, they could have expelled her. We still contend...
Could they have done that without breaching their fiduciary duty?
We don't think so. Here's why.
Well, is the consequence of that argument then that they could not expel her without incurring liability?
Not at all. Not at all. Here's how we got to where we are. The Court of Appeals relied on these out-of-state cases. These cases weren't briefed by either party in the Court of Appeals. And the first time anybody saw them was in the opinion of the Court of Appeals. But because they weren't briefed, the Court of Appeals, I don't believe, considered those cases correctly. Those out-of-state cases relied upon by the Court of Appeals say quite clearly that one of the limits on the freedom of partners to contract among themselves, a freedom recognized by all those courts and certainly should be recognized by this court, is that they may not violate public policy. In the Gelder case, for example, this is, I'd like to read.
Well, and I'm interested in your further explanation, but could you first address the question of how does Butler and Binion or any other partnership choose not to continue to be partners with one or more members of the partnership without violating a fiduciary duty? Or can they?
Well, yes, they can.
And how do you do that? That concerns me.
Well, if a partner is not producing, it is not a violation of the fiduciary duty to say that we're going to expel you because you're not producing. At that point, there has been no breach of fiduciary duty unless, in the unlikely event, that partner can show that there was a lack of honesty or a lack of good faith or a lack of loyalty, or a failure to disclose information. And the burden is on that partner. And that's always been the standard in Texas. And a lot of the partners have been expelled for failing to produce, and it hasn't fomented litigation.
What if you just don't like the partner? You want them gone?
That's fine.
Well, why is that a good thing?
Again, it depends on some of the facts. I've got some partners I'd love to expel because
right.
I don't like them, but I haven't. On the other hand, Your Honor, if they brought in a big barrel of money, and I expel them the day before they get their share of the money, then they probably can prove that I haven't acted honestly, that I haven't acted with loyalty.
Is it because of the reason why Butler and Binion, you say, expelled Ms. Bohatch?
Yes, Your Honor. The evidence in this case...
If they had done it for reasons of economics or because they just didn't want to be associated with her anymore, because there was a conflict of personalities, there would be no breach of fiduciary duty?
If she had not made this report, if they had said, for example, that she was a poor lawyer, they could have expelled her for that reason. If there had been some evidence in this case that there was, in fact, a conflict of personalities, and I submit this record contains no evidence of that, even after she made the report, Mr. McDonald said, I'll continue to work with her and I'll supervise her work if that's what Pennzoil wants. And Mr. Payne testified, I had no idea, and I don't believe it's true, that McDonald refused to supervise her work. So those facts don't exist in this case.
If he had, would that make a difference?
If who had done what?
Mr. McDonald had refused to supervise the work.
No, Your Honor, I don't think so, because Mr. Payne had some options that is ignored by the Court of Appeals opinion. There was another partner in that Washington, D.C. office, and he also worked only for Pennzoil, Mr. Powers. She could work with him. She could work. And Pennzoil never said, we don't want to work with Ms. Bohatch. They testified explicitly that they wanted to continue her working on the firm. They just wanted the final on their work. They just wanted the final product reviewed for a while.
If one of the partners in the firm goes to the senior partner or management committee and reports that another partner is not adequately representing clients, just bad judgment, bad advice, not doing all that ought to be done, and the other partners don't feel that way and that comes to light, it's kind of hard to continue the relationship after that, isn't it?
It depends on the specific facts of the case and how it's reported. Ms. Bohatch did everything right. She looked at the internal records for a long time. She deliberated with her partner. She sought legal advice, and she reported very discreetly to Lewis Payne what she thought.
Once she made this allegation, how long was the firm required to keep her as a partner? When could they expel her under the partnership agreement without breaching the fiduciary duty?
I think as long as the reason that they expelled her was because that she had followed the requirements of the D.C. Bar, followed her ethical obligation, as long as that was the reason they were expelling her, they could not do it. If something else had come up in the future, they could have expelled her for some other reason, just like any partner can be expelled for any other reason that does not violate public policy. And here there's no question about what the public policy is at this stage.
Dr. You started to say there are three reasons why the CFM was incorrect and we've interrupted. What are the other two?
The second reason is that the Court of Appeals failed to review the sufficiency of the evidence based upon the definition of fiduciary duty submitted by the trial court, despite the defendant's failure to object to that definition, and despite the fact that the definition submitted is correct. It violated this court's rule in the Sage Street case. The Sage Street case applied to a factual sufficiency review, but the same reasons should apply to a legal sufficiency. The third reason is the court said that it was conducting a legal sufficiency, a no-evidence review of the evidence. But in fact, it did not. It acted as a juror. It acted as a jury and reviewed the evidence as if it were a jury. Looking at page 10, for example, of the Court of Appeals opinion, you see repeatedly that they are referring to facts that are favorable to the defendant. And the standard of a no-evidence review is well known to this court. The court may only consider those facts which are favorable to the one who has prevailed and the inferences to be drawn therefrom, and may not consider the matters that are contrary.
And your argument in this case is that in considering the legal sufficiency of the evidence, we may not even consider the fact that Pennzoil was satisfied or said they were satisfied with the bid.
That's correct.
It's a whole different case whether Pennzoil was satisfied or they weren't satisfied.
No, it's not, Your Honor. It makes no difference whether Pennzoil was satisfied or not. What makes a difference is whether Ms. Bohatch had a good faith belief that he was overbilling the client. That's the standard by which we are obligated to report. And we can be wrong. We can make mistakes. But if we have a good faith belief, and if we're acting to protect the client, as she was, and she testified, my sole motivation was to protect the client, that's what this court ought to foster. That's what the public policy of this state ought to support. There is nobody else out there who's going to know when a client is being overbilled in this situation other than the lawyers. If you will look at the bills, the client didn't know. And if you read the testimony of Mr. Shattuck and Mr. Chapman, the attorneys for Pennzoil, they did not and could not know whether they were being overbilled because the bills give no information from which one can determine that.
But doesn't it make it difficult for one partner in a law firm to work with another partner in a law firm who has, in essence, greed?
Sure, it makes it difficult. But
have to keep doing it.
Life is full of difficulties, and partners have disputes among themselves all the time that get resolved. The question here is, who's the court going to support with its opinion here? A partner who was fully, who was clearly overbilling his client, and the record is absolutely clear that he was overbilling the client.
Was there any evidence what the fee agreement was with Pinpoint?
Yes, the testimony is that it was hourly based upon the work done. And her complaint, and that's undisputed, mm-hmm. and her observation was that he was simply not doing the work. He was billing on the order of 10 to 12 hours a day, and he was working about 3 to 4 hours a day. And Mr. Powers agreed with her.
After Pennzoil and the firm reviewed the billing records, wasn't there an assessment that there was no overbilling?
By Pennzoil and
correct.
By the firm.
Correct.
And the record
Pennzoil said, we've looked at it, but there is no overbilling.
Yes, Your Honor, but what the record also reflects is that when Butler and Binion went to Pennzoil, they deceived their client. They went to Mr. Chapman, and they told him that she had retaliated against Mr. McDonald after Mr. McDonald had raised a suggestion about her work. But the facts were just the opposite. They also said, Chapman testified that Mr. McDonald said that there was a lot of acrimony from her. But Mr. McDonald said, no, she just sat there in stunned silence. There was no acrimony. Mr. Payne confirmed that. So the evidence was
quite... Well, silence can be deadly also. I mean, the fact that you're silent...
Well, the fact of the matter is there was no acrimony, and she testified to that. And they misled the client, so the client never looked. Mr. Chapman never conducted a review. When this was reported to him, and he testified it was reporting as a billing irregularity, he said, I've already reviewed the bills. Mr. Shaddix only talked to Mr. Chapman. There was no review of the bill. And again, if you look at the bills, you will see you can't tell whether you're being overbilled, that they don't reflect who's doing the work, how many hours are spent, or even much detail about work that's done. I see my time is up.
You were responding to a question from Justice Tech. He had asked you, does it make a difference when one partner has grieved another to expect them to work together, and you were in the middle of responding to that question.
I believe I said that partners have difficulties among themselves of all sorts at all times and continue to work together.
But it doesn't usually involve turning each other into the bar association or copying each other's daily diaries without anybody knowing it, or going to meetings or starting investigations or bad-mouthing a partner's work to a senior partner. It usually doesn't involve too much of that.
Well, this case doesn't either. There was no bad-mouthing of a partner's work to a senior partner.
You say that Mr. McDonald did that to Mr. Payne.
To?
Bad-mouth Ms. Bohatch's work to Mr. Payne.
Mr. McDonald said to Ms. Bohatch that your work is not doing
good. And told the senior partners and told that's what he thought and that's what Pennzoil thought.
He did say that, Your Honor. I believe the answer to the question is that Mr. Payne had several options available to him, and he took the absolute worst option. He was the managing partner of the firm. His first obligation was to see what the facts are. And he and Mr. Burns said, we're going to expel the partner who's not telling the truth. The quote investigation that they did was absolutely not an investigation at all. They did not look at anything that would help them determine whether or not the client was being overbilled.
I'm trying to get to the bigger issue, not the facts of this case. Let's suppose you're in a two-man partnership, and your partner files a grievance against you, and you decide you want to dissolve the partnership. Shouldn't you have that right? Are you going to require those two partners to maintain an ongoing partnership relationship, although they despise one another?
No, but I don't think in the facts, those are not the facts of
this
case.
Well, I'm asking the broader principle. Where do we draw the line between a two-man firm and a 200-person firm? What do you do with a two-man firm where one partner files a grievance against the other and no action is taken by the bar committee? Do you require that you prevent the partner who was grieved from dissolving the partnership?
Well, dissolving the partnership may be one thing. Expelling the other partner and ending that other partner's career.
Well, let's say it's a three-person partnership, and the other two decide to expel the partner. Are you going to tie their hand and say they can't expel that partner?
I think that's right, because I think that first lawyer is obligated by this court's rule to grieve the other partners. And the consequence of that must not be that they're expelled from the partnership. The consequence of complying with the ethical requirements of this court must not be that they can be expelled. Otherwise, it would be a strange person who would ever do such a thing.
And how long do you require those three people to practice law together as partners?
Well, until such time as they can dissolve a partnership or expel a partner for some other reason other than for violating a public or for complying with public policy.
Any other? The Butler-Vinion partnership agreement, I assume, has a provisions about dissolving, dissolution of the partnership?
It does.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument and respond.
May it please the court.
The
foreman and the counsel
will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Holman,
will open the court. May it please the court. My name is David Holman, and I, together with my co-counsel, Richard Countess, represent the respondents. I was prepared to give one argument today, but after hearing Mr. Tucker's argument, I think I need to address a couple of the court's concerns. First of all, Mr. Tucker said that there was no evidence in the record that Mr. McDonald didn't want to work with him. That's completely
wrong.
Well,
let's not get off on rabbit trails.
I mean, all right.
Well, y'all mainly making claims you don't need to make. He has to show some evidence. You have to show no evidence to support these findings the jury makes.
Exactly. But I wanted to point out to the court that he said that after I found out she was lying about me, I didn't want to work with her. In Pennzoil, it's undisputed in the record that Pennzoil testified numerous times about her poor performance and that they told McDonald about this in mid-May or early June. They told him about it. And told him that they didn't want her doing any work in which she wasn't supervised. Now, you have to understand, this is a three-person office in Washington, D.C. They have one client, Pennzoil. Two of the lawyers, Bo Hatch and Powers, were regular lawyers. McDonald was the supervisory partner that had the contact with Pennzoil.
But assuming he was overbilled, and assuming that Pennzoil was upset about it, and she blows the whistle, as it were, and in retaliation, after the smoke clears, they fire. Is that a problem?
I think assuming that she was that he was in fact overbilled, assuming that the client had problems with it.
So the only way she has a case is if she's right.
No, I didn't say that. Let's assume that everything that she says is true. What then was the partnership to do? Was the partnership supposed to fire McDonald when the client was perfectly satisfied with him? Were they supposed to expel both of them? Were they supposed to expel McDonald when they had essentially unfounded accusations? You'll find, if you review the record, that at every time that Mr. Payne was faced with a choice, every time, he chose the high road. He chose to report it immediately to the client. He chose to conduct an investigation. He chose to report it to the state bar. He chose, instead of giving her the guillotine method of severance, which is speedy, quick expulsion without cause, which the courts have approved, he gave her the step-down severance.
I have a little different question, though, and that is, assuming he had, assuming he meant to do her harm, but in the...
When you say he had...
Mr. Payne, McDonald, the management committee of the firm.
All right.
They said, we don't want somebody among us who blows the whistle on us to the bar. We just don't want to work with them. Irrespective of how much business they bring in, that's kind of hard to imagine. Irrespective of a lot of other factors, we just don't. So you're asked for doing this. Is that a breach of fiduciary duty?
Yes and no. Let me give you my best assessment of that analysis of that question. This court certainly has the power to intervene in contract disputes on the basis of public policy. There's no question about it. In the Phillips versus Phillips case that you wrote, Justice Act, in Texas, this court issued in 1991, you said that a contract that is illegal will not be enforced as a matter of public policy. It was an agreement between partners in which one partner said that, well, if we have any actual damages, mine will be 10 times the actual damages, and that, of course, could not be enforceable. If their conduct here contravened the laws of this state, in other words, were illegal, then I think that you could say that public policy should step in and intervene.
Well, but you're begging the question. My question is very simple. If they fire her for whistleblowing, is that a breach of fiduciary duty?
I don't believe so. And I'll tell you why. First of all, fiduciary duties deal with the business aspects of the partnership, business and property of the partnership. There is a separate cause of action for retaliatory discharge, it's called. That cause of action has only been recognized in very few instances in at-will type agreements. The courts in other states that have looked at this particular problem, when you have an expulsion provision on the one side that says you can expel her for any cause, doesn't matter if it's good, bad, you can expel her for any cause. We're not going to import a four-cause requirement in that expulsion. Of course, there's a good reason for that, because the whole idea of a partnership is an expression of will. You want to be somebody's partner. At some point when you don't want to be somebody's partner, for whatever reason, the policy of the court should be that the partners are entitled to have an expeditious severance. That's what the court
says. But there is a difference between you and I don't want to be partners anymore, we dissolve, and you
and
don't
I'm
want
trying
to be my
to cover,
partner, so I'm out.
Yeah. There's a difference between, and you know, dovetailing with what Justice Heck was asking, there's also a difference between saying, well, I'm going to cover up, and you reported to me that this guy's overbilling, I'm going to cover up that by getting rid of you so that this issue doesn't come up. But that's not what we have here. We have a situation where it was immediately reported to the client. It was immediately investigated. The client conducted its own investigation. They reported to the state bar, although that evidence was excluded by the court, we think wrongfully. They did everything. They chose the high road in every situation.
We can say that, counsel, but the Court of Appeals chronicles over a 14-month period that the firm took away, didn't assign her any more work, then reduced her partnership interest, then withheld her year-end distribution, then cut off her draw, and finally, on October the 21st, 1991, formally expelled her.
That's the step-down severance. And the reason that's called the step-down severance, the Wallace case talks about that. They had a choice of just cutting her off and expelling her completely. But instead of expelling her, they allowed what's called a step-down severance. During that whole period of time, during that whole year, she did no work for the firm. She billed no hours. The firm had no option.
They didn't give her any work, did they?
Well, yes, that's true. They did not give her any work because there's
no hours if she doesn't have any work.
Well, she admitted in the trial below that it's the obligation of the partner to find work to do. And she said in a number of her letters, I'm working on business development activities. In fact, Burns said they asked him, well, how could she have remained a partner? And he said, well, if she could have landed a big client, that would have helped. You know, if she'd brought in any business, that would have helped. But she never brought in any work. They had a decision
would she have to do that if you had Penzoil as your only client and you're billing $1.2 million a year?
Well, because her supervisor didn't want to work for her and because Penzoil didn't want her to work for it without supervision. And she was offered an opportunity.
No, you said a minute ago that Penzoil was dissatisfied with her work before she reported the overbilling. Was that communicated to her?
No, it was not. It was communicated for the first time on the day after she reported the overbilling to Mr. Payne. And that was before Mr. Payne had contacted Mr. McDonald to let him know about Mrs. Bohatch's complaints. But Ms. Bohatch believes that the reason for that was that Powers had communicated to McDonald about the overbilling and that McDonald was then communicating to her in retaliation. But of course the Penzoil folks, who were the disinterested witnesses at trial, they testified we communicated to him in mid-May and told him we didn't want her to do any work without being supervised because of her poor performance. And they detailed, I mean they talked about it. The specific instances where they were dissatisfied with the work. And they talked about the people at Penzoil who were dissatisfied with the work.
Wouldn't the fiduciary duty that one partner owes another require at some point Butler and Binion to tell Ms. Bohatch, the client doesn't want you doing their work anymore.
Yeah.
You're going to need to find other work, or you're going to need to be reassigned to other section, or basically it's not economically feasible to maintain you within the partnership, and we might ultimately have to terminate or expel you from the partnership for financial reasons.
That's exactly what she was told by Lewis Payne at the August 23rd meeting.
Said that's August the 23rd, what year?
1990. He came to her and said, our investigation reveals no overbilling. Pennzoil said that they're satisfied with your work. I can't imagine this supervisory partner wanting to work with you after you've accused him of his criminal conduct. Basically, he said, I think it would be in your best interest and the best interest of the partnership for you to look for other work. And in order to help you look for other work, we've decided we're going to give you this period of time where you can collect a draw of $7,500 a month, maintain your office, maintain your secretary, maintain your phone, maintain your insurance benefits. We're not going to expel you just yet.
So you're saying that the decision to expel her essentially had been formed on August the 23rd, 1990. They were just going to draw it out over a period of time. So she really wasn't given an opportunity to develop other work. It was a decision really made at that time.
They hadn't made the formal decision to expel her. They had said that they thought it was in her best interest to look for other work, and they said that will be given an opportunity to remain here as a partner while you're looking for other work and do no work. And that's exactly what she did. She did no work at all.
Do you object to, well, you do in your briefs, but explain, does this court have any alternative other than to review this evidence under the standards submitted to the jury that you did not object to?
Absolutely. They're talking about that this court is somehow bound by the definition of duty that's in the jury charge. And, of course, the jury doesn't make a determination of duty. That's a court-made determination. The court determines the duty based upon the facts and surrounding circumstances. That's exactly what the Court of Appeals did. We raised the issue of duty in our post-trial motions.
Doesn't the argument go that the instruction submitted to the jury didn't include the phrase for self-gain, and that is the crux of the Court of Appeals decision? And so the argument is that you're supposed to review, in their view, no evidence claims in light of the question and instruction submitted to the jury, and that didn't happen in this case.
I have no problem with that concept if you're talking about disputed fact issues. You're talking about what the jury was instructed to do. But if you're talking about a duty, that's particularly unique to the court's determination. The jury
doesn't
make
that duty is a factual issue. Determining the duty is a law issue.
That's
breaching
right.
The duty is a fact issue. And if the judge instructs the jury on what the law is through an instruction, and it's not objected to, how can we in the appellate courts clean that up and pretend that the jury's breach finding was on another duty and look to see if there's evidence of that and resolve a case on this hypothetical basis that the jury didn't know about?
Well, I submit to you that the case of Shell Oil Company versus Humphrey, which is a Houston 14th case, 1994, addresses that directly. It says that the failure to object to a instruction, when you're not complaining about the submission you're not complaining about the submission of the issue, you're complaining that there's no evidence because there's no duty.
But there was some duty here.
Well, it's a limited duty. That's what you're
questioning.
But there
is a duty. You're saying that you don't deny there's a duty, but you deny that this case should have ever gone to the jury. There should have been an instructive verdict.
That's correct. And, you know, he mentions that these cases that the Court of Appeals relied on were never briefed, but of course you'll see in the briefing in the record that these were briefed in the trial court. We were alleging that they did not have they did not have this broad-based duty. And there's a good reason for that. The relationship with
Let me get back to this. You said twice in your brief, I think, well, we did preserve it in our post-trial motions, but you were very vague about exactly what you did. Can you tell us what you asked for specifically that goes to this whole issue of duty and where you asked for?
I can't. I haven't reviewed the post-trial motions. I had reviewed the initial. There were numerous post-trial motions that were submitted in this case. post-trial motions, there were two submitted before I even got involved in the case. There was in the post-trial motions that I submitted, motions for new trial and so forth, I made a no evidence challenge. And under Bill Powers' article, which is the another look at no evidence, no duty issues are subsets of duty issues are subsets of a no evidence challenge. So when you make a no evidence challenge,
you're
free to
argue. But you can see that there's a duty of some, there's some fiduciary duty here. Or are you saying there is no fiduciary duty of any kind?
Well, under this record, there's no breach of fiduciary duty, but you're asking whether this court should recognize some duty at all? Or
no, I'm asking whether under these circumstances there is a fiduciary duty of some kind or another.
Yes, I believe there is. I think that the courts have unanimously, that have dealt with this question, have unanimously held there is some duty, but it's limited to whether another partner is expelling you in order to get a advantage for himself.
Is that always the case?
No, I don't believe it is always the case. In fact, if that were always the case, I think it would be a meaningless standard. But you're not trying to gain the concept of fiduciary duty arises from the business aspects or property of the partnership. And so, for example, I can lie to my partner about what the score of the Cowboys game was last week, and that's not a breach of fiduciary duty. Similarly, I can conceal from my partner the fact that I loaned my brother-in-law $1,000. That's not a breach of fiduciary duty.
But here, this court and the D.C. local court of appeals have written some rules to put some obligation on lawyers. And if there is some evidence that this lawyer had a good faith belief that events that had happened at the firm called upon her to fulfill that duty that the court had promulgated by making some report to her managing partner, isn't a retaliation based on that exercise a violation of the type of fiduciary burdens that we have imposed upon lawyers in a partnership?
I don't believe so. I think that would be more along the lines of retaliatory discharge and not breach of fiduciary duty. Breach of fiduciary duty deals with trying to get a profit at another partner's expense. And what, you know, Mr. Tucker mentioned, the fiduciary with his hand in the till, or the guy that expels a partner and doesn't want to give him his share. I mean, those kind of things certainly would be a breach of fiduciary duty.
But that considers a law partnership merely to be a business. And I guess we have these perhaps archaic notions that law partnerships and law practice is something other than just a business.
I don't think those are archaic notions, Judge. And I think in this situation, if they had done something to take advantage of her, I think that would be one thing. But I think what we have, we're
so the duty might be broader than purely a business.
No, I think it's self-gain, and self-gain can be, you know, a broad concept. If you were trying to improve your position within the firm by getting rid of a partner, I think that might be a breach of fiduciary duty as well. But I think that what we're really confronted with here is kind of a reversal of the old maxim. We're talking about two rights don't make a wrong. She may have been right in reporting overbilling. I'm sure she thought she was right in reporting overbilling, even though she didn't have documentation. And on the other hand, nothing that Payne did was wrong. He did the right things in responding to that situation, and he should not be subjected to liability for the things that he did. Because if he is, then we're going to force partners to remain together who aren't supposed to be together. We're going to force people not to tell the state bar, not to tell the client, not to conduct investigations. I mean, everything that he did was in order to try and resolve a situation that had grown intolerable. And the cases say that removal of a partner in order to resolve a fundamental schism in the partnership is not a breach of fiduciary duty, whatever the parameters of fiduciary duty.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We took about 3 minutes of your time, three questions. Answered more than we needed. He answered about 4 minutes worth, but if you add 3 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I simply want to address in the short time remaining
two of our cross points, because I think two of these cross points, frankly, eliminate the need to even address most of the problems this court has been talking about for the last 20 to 25 minutes. Unless this court overrules Southwestern Bell versus Delaney and Parkway versus Woodruff, Ms. Bohatch has nothing except a cause of action, if any cause of action, for breach of contract. That's her only area. That's the only litigation area where she can work. Here's one. Delaney was based primarily on this court's opinion in the 1940s International Press Man, which a union member was expelled from the union, and the court found a contract in that case, and then faced the question of whether the union man had a contract action or a tort action. And the court used this analysis. It said an action in contract for breach of duty arising out of a contract is either expressed or implied. An action in tort is for the breach of a duty imposed by law. Now, that's a nice, amorphous statement, but what does it mean? I think it means, and I think this is what the court said in Delaney, if the cause of action stands alone, if it exists regardless of the existence of the contract, then it can be a tort cause of action. But if its very existence is dependent upon the existence of the contract, then the cause of action is for breach of contract.
Well, if there wasn't a partnership agreement here, though, there would still be a duty, wouldn't there, not a fiduciary duty?
And that depends on what relationship is if there is no contract, if there is no partnership agreement. If they are, in fact, partners under the law, as most of us, unfortunately, have been at one time or another, we don't have a partnership agreement, we just say, let's be partners. That's still a contract. It's contract implied in law, and the suit would still be for breach of that contract. Her relationship's got to be one or the other in this kind of situation. It can only be an employee at will in which there is no fiduciary duty.
But you can still bring a cause of action against your partner for breach of fiduciary duty.
Against your partner if... Yes, under the correct circumstances, the correct facts, certainly, that cause of action.
But the fact that your underlying fiduciary duty arises from the partnership agreement doesn't negate a tort cause of action or breach of fiduciary duty.
It may not negate it, but under the language of Delaney and Pressman, it can exist only if it would exist without the partnership agreement, because that's what those cases say. They say if there is no contract, if the tort can exist without the contract,
for example,
then there can be a tort cause of action.
As a partner, you're not supposed to usurp partnership opportunities without telling your other partners about it and getting their permission.
Correct.
Suppose that's not spelled out. You have an at-will implied in that partnership agreement, and a partner does violate that, and you can still sue them for a breach of fiduciary duty even though their relationship is based on a contract.
Well, yes, but you sue them because they're taking something that belongs to you. In fact, they're stealing from you.
But still a breach of fiduciary duty as opposed to a breach of a partnership.
It may be. It may be. It always depends on the facts and circumstances. But I come back again to Pressman and Delaney. If you could not sue them but for the contract, then your cause of action is for breach of contract.
So that the an attorney who is not a partner who reports a grievance of some sort would have a tort cause of action?
No, an attorney who is not a partner would be guided by the terms of the partnership agreement and probably would be, well, it just depends on the terms of the partnership agreement. But I don't think in that circumstance there would be a tort cause of action. I can't imagine.
He could be fired at will.
Yes, unless there's something in the contract that prohibits it.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tom.
I said I would be assisted by Mr. Thomas, and let me give a better answer to Justice Owens' question about the three partnership firm situation. The better answer is that we're not saying that the partner who reports the grievance can't be expelled if he reports on an ethical violation in a three-person firm. But we are saying that if he is expelled for doing that he has a cause of action based upon breach of fiduciary duty for any damages that he can prove. The other option is for the partners to do what was testified was an option in this case, and that is if they've stepped across the line, they can step back and get on the right side of the line. Behavior can be changed, and that is the purpose for reporting requirements, to call that to the attention of lawyers and have lawyers conform their behavior
to the rules.
But in a three-man office, that's a fairly significant breach of trust, is it not? For one lawyer to report another?
It is. Well, I don't think it's a breach of...
And let's assume that the state bar took no action. There has been a report. It's questionable whether it was a violation or not, but if there's been a report, are you still going to say that the other two partners, their hands are tied, they can't expel the partner who made the call, who was obligated, who had a good faith belief, and who was obligated to report? And what do you do in that situation where you have a breach of trust among the partners?
Well, the answer I gave before is that no, they couldn't expel him, but I think that's the wrong answer. The answer is they can't expel the partner.
They have to pay for it.
They have to pay for it if there are any damages.
What damages would there be if you follow the partnership agreement in expelling them?
There may be none. There may be none. But not each of those, that would determine.
The damages would only come if you expelled them in violation of the agreement about how to split up the assets.
If you violate them in breach of the fiduciary duty, then there are tort damages because that is a tort. And it depends on what the facts of the case may be. The argument that there is no duty, I think, is wrong for two reasons. The legislature in Section 31 of the Partnership Act recognizes that the bona fide requirement involved in a dissolution or expulsion of a partner. And this court has, throughout its jurisprudence, recognized that the fiduciary duty exists. I don't think this court has to answer that question.
Doesn't this boil down to, or not, whether it's bona fide to expel a partner in a law firm for reporting another partner's violation of the ethical code?
Absolutely. That's what the case is all about.
I mean,
and there is no jurisprudence anywhere else in the country on that point.
That's incorrect, and that is incorrect, Your Honor. There are three cases that were cited by the Court of Appeals that address this issue. Please look at Reed against Bifflin Brewer, Gelder Medical Center against Weber, and the Lee against Crescent Square case. Each of those cases says that a partnership is free to expel persons for whatever reason, as long as the language is a little different in the cases, but generally they say as long as there's not overreaching, undue advantage, or breach of a public policy. Those cases,
this public policy has not.
No. The closest case is cited in one of the amicus briefs, Leonard Gross's amicus brief. It's the Weider case out of the Court of Appeals of New York. It's a different situation. He was not a partner. He was an employee. And there, the Court of Appeals of New York fashioned an exception to the at-will doctrine, something I am not asking this court to do, because I know this court won't do that, and I don't want this court to do that, so please don't misunderstand me. But the only answer to your question, Justice Hull, is that in that instance, the New York Court of Appeals did say that the public policy of New York is that when an employee in a law firm reports a violation, as he's required to do by the New York rules, that he has a cause of action when he is fired for doing so.
Well, I'm going to take your yes as a no.
Let me ask you, the way the charge was presented, I was kind of curious. You apparently did not object in fashioning the charge that specifically says termination of a partner in accordance with the partnership agreement does not constitute a breach of fiduciary duty. So if they had dotted their I's and crossed their T's in terminating her, under the way you submitted it to the jury, she would not have a cause of action, even if the termination, the reason for the termination had been she filed a grievance.
I think I should have objected, frankly, to that charge. Judge Brewer, there had been numerous rulings, and Judge Brister, who, by the way, fashioned that charge, it was not fashioned by us, but had already ruled on that, and I wasn't going to argue with it anymore. I'd been battered enough. But probably I should have made an objection.
But
the fact
your
of the matter is, I did
this
not.
This defines the duty.
It does.
If that's the case.
It does define the duty. But the facts of this case are that they didn't do that. They first discharged her on August the 23rd of 1990 when he came to Washington, D.C. and said, go find another job. They discharged her again in January of 1991 when they secretly took away her partnership interest. And they discharged her again when they said, we're cutting off your money, go find another place. Thank you for hearing our case. I want to conclude with saying the stake in this case is whether the practice of law is about money only. Is the avoidance of self-gain to be the only restraint on law partners' treatment of one another? Or are we to continue to be required to behave toward our law partners with honesty, good faith, loyalty, and honor? Thank you for hearing.
Any other questions? That concludes the arguments for today, and both all the foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise.